Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 15, delivered on March 16, 2016. The title of this lecture is Stock.
Today, Stock. Now, I went right before the exam, I went through bonds, which is the generic term for debt. Instruments. Stock is sort of the generic term for equity instruments. There are a variety of ways that equity can be issued by a company, and I probed that on the exam. You can, of course, there's common stock and preferred stock, but equity can also be that part of the earnings of the company that the company does not distribute as dividends. So, this is kind of a narrow approach because what I'll be talking about mostly here is common stock. Common stock is the most common. Apparently, that's why they call it common. But at the same time, common stock is obviously the most common kind of equity instrument. The certificate itself, actually, anymore, I'm not all that sure that many companies actually issue the certificates. Back in my time and for since time immemorial, there was a stock certificate. That was your evidence of your ownership position. Now, the stock certificate as a physical instrument has sort of gone away in the electronic age, at least to some extent. Although there is still the stock transfer agent, which is a company or an individual that handles moving stock from one from a seller to the new the new owner, the buyer, issuing the stock and keeping all the records of the stock that's been issued. Stock transfer agents are still around. Back in my time, there were some small stock transfer agents I worked for. I don't think any of those are around. It's all done by these huge companies now. But anyway, to the basics of stock. Stock, common stock represents ownership in the corporation. If there are, now there is an authorized number of shares. That's how many shares the company's capital stock is divided into when the company forms. This company has 100 million shares of let me say it the right way. You don't have to know this exactly, but it would say in the Articles of Incorporation, the capital stock of this corporation is divided into 100 million shares of common stock. Now, most companies have a par value attached to each share. It's just an ancient artifact, and makes for some accounting weirdness. I'll show that to you here in a minute. But it will say par value, $0.001 per share common. That actually, to my understanding, and there is a little bit of dispute about this among people that I know, experts, it actually, that par value represented the liability of the owner of the stock. If you had 100 shares and the par value was a penny a share, your liability for the company's debts would be a dollar. Some companies have no par value. They issue it nowadays. I've been surprised in recent years running into companies no par value. I guess it's okay to do it. I always created companies with par value. Tell you a quick little story about setting up. The authorized number of shares is how many shares can ever be issued. So you got to make sure that you've got enough out there for distribution for giving stock to the insiders, for selling stock in your first public offering or in your first private placement, for subsequent offerings to raise money, equity, or for subsequent giving of stock as bonuses to the employees, whatever. That authorized number of shares is your limit. Changing the charter of a corporation is a major thing that you never really want to do. So make sure you have a lot of those par value, that capital stock, that common stock authorized. Now here's the story. Now I knew this, and I formed corporations, and I always did them, incorporated them in the state of Delaware. You don't have to have the company in the state where its main business operations are. I set up companies in Delaware, which meant that they were domestic in Delaware and foreign in every other state. But I did it because Delaware has a very mature corporation law. Its judges, called magistrates, are steeped in understanding of business law going back to ancient times. So I generally used Delaware. Well, one time I created a corporation. It was for a client, but I created it for myself, and then I would essentially be able to control it until I could release it to the company officials once I knew that they had their major act together. I formed one in Ohio, and I made it with 100 million shares of common stock authorized. Well, I got my first franchise tax bill from the state at the end of that year, and I nearly had a heart attack because the bill was for, I think it was for $1 million. I had to pay them. I almost died right there. I thought, well, you know, I started checking plane tickets out of the country and everything else. It turned out that Ohio assessed the franchise tax at that time based on the number of shares authorized. So at a penny a share authorized, 100 million share corporation came out to have a franchise tax for the year of $1 million. I mean, I was just like, are you out of your minds? That's why one of the reasons I'll tell you what states are hostile to corporations or not good places. Ohio, I would say never incorporate in Ohio. Maybe they've changed it since then. There are other states that are not a good idea to incorporate in. There are other states that are really good to incorporate in. Ohio, after that, I essentially called the state, the Secretary of State, and I said, what the hell am I going to do? And they said, well, it's okay. You can just shut down your corporation, and we won't bill you. We won't hold you. So in other words, either pony up your million or close down your corporation. So, in other words, Ohio is a state in which I would never incorporate again, as long as I live. But anyway, okay, now, the authorized is how many shares, your limit of how much you can distribute forever. Okay, now, then there is the outstanding. That's the stock that has been issued. Now, the insiders that start a corporation will probably give themselves a buttload of stock to start with. And I did that with all the corporations I ever started. I gave them a good, solid pile of stock. Enough so that when we had to go and sell stock, they would still have more than 50% control of the corporation. So, in other words, if I were to figure that our first public offering would have to be for 1 million shares, and over the next 10, 20, 30 years, we'd probably do 5 to 8 more million, I would have to make sure that the insiders, as a group, had at least 20 million shares. Probably there would be one person who would say, I want at least 50% of whatever is ever going to be issued. Then there would be a war on the inside because you'd have others who say, no, we don't want him controlling the corporation. We want to control it as a group. And so there'd be a dogfight about that. But anyway, there's your setup. Now, the insiders will get stock. However, They cannot simply sell their stock whenever they want. That stock will be subject to Rule 144 of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. It's called restricted stock. And back in the day, it literally had a big red stamp, restricted, on it. It could not be sold without the opinion of legal counsel that the exceptions under Rule 144 were in play. Rule 144 allows for sales of restricted stock with the opinion of legal counsel that it's okay to do it, with the understanding that there cannot be more than a certain amount sold in any given time frame, and that it cannot be sold prior to release of news of one kind or another. And those sales must be registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Generally speaking, that stock is intended, at least to some extent, as reward for the entrepreneurial factor of production. They also represent the foundation of stock of the company and offer the insiders the ability to vote for the board of directors who will be on it and all of that, to declare dividends, to make management decisions until managers are in place. The board of directors is elected by the shareholders. Generally speaking, you'll have a president of the board, a secretary, a treasurer, and such other board members as are deemed appropriate. Distinguish that from the executive management. The executive management is hired by the board of directors. That includes the chief executive officer, the chief financial officer, the chief operating officer, and these days, one that you never would have seen in the back earlier. Okay, there's the CEO, the CFO, the COO. Does anyone know the other one that's very common now in companies? Yeah. No. We'll never let a marketer be on the board. That's good. You know? Yeah.
CTO.
Not CTO. I know it, you got the right idea, but it's the CIO, Chief Information Officer. Yeah, that one's an executive level. Then they are the deciders, the decision makers on the operations of the company, under the supervision of the board of directors, which represents the will of the owners, the stockholders of the company. So you've got this layered approach. That means that the board of directors has fiduciary duty to the shareholders, because the shareholders cannot directly intervene in the operations of the company. They must rely upon the faith, loyalty, and trust of the board of directors. Now, I'm going to go into fiduciary duty, and I think I should do that in my next lecture. I'm going to probably do agency in my next lecture, because you need to know about, some of you who are in my Business 100 class might remember my flaming talk about fiduciary duty. But it's real, and the board of directors must be acting in the interest of the shareholders of the company. That is a major challenge in reality. The operationalization of that is a major challenge, especially in recent years. Is it really in the interest of the board of the shareholders to pay the executive officers tens of millions of dollars for what is often lackluster performance? And yet that's how it works, is that the board of directors hires the executive managers and then awards them incredible salaries, far, far in excess of salaries of executives anywhere else in the world, oftentimes for performance that is lackluster with regard to the company's success for the stockholders. That I'll have more to say about that in a subsequent lecture, especially in the talk about fiduciary duty. But anyway, so here's the deal. Original sales of stock are called sales in the primary market. When a company wants to raise funds by selling common stock, it is going to do that in the primary market. Subsequently, when owners of stock sell it and new owners buy it, that happens in the secondary market. The transactions in the primary market are governed by the Securities Act of 1933 as amended. The sales of stock in the secondary market are governed generally by the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. As amended. You see, those two acts were part of a mass of legislation that was passed once the great crash of 29 had happened and the great recession, a great depression had happened, and all of the pro-business members of Congress and the presidents who had fueled the catastrophe for years were kicked out on their asses in the 1932 elections. Reform swept the business world. And I mean, it was not the kind of reform that is the stuff that you see today. It was hardcore. The Securities and Exchange Commission was enabled by the Securities Act of 1934 to oversee all regulatory matters regarding securities markets. Now, their record has been sort of up and down how well they've done it. Back in my time, when I was a consultant for companies going public and all of that, they weren't who I was afraid of. They were helpful. They pretended they were. We cannot offer you advice. I'd call them, well, we can't offer you advice. And then after a while, we talk, and they give me what I needed to know to make sure that I was doing things right. The ones I was afraid of, just terrified of, were the state securities regulators. For the most part, they were a bunch of dog beaters, cat stranglers, nose pickers, child molesters, and otherwise idiots and nefarious dogs. And that's my good opinion of them. To give you an idea of how scary it got in that time, at one point I had done a reverse merger, and I'm going to teach you about the different kinds of mergers as this lecture goes on today. But I had done a reverse merger of a dead public company into a private living company. Now, the reason I would do this is because the dead public company had already registered with the SEC sometime decades before, or even in one case, over a century before. And what I do is I would insert a living private company into it to sort of make it come to life as a public company. The SEC was cool with what I had done, but there were a couple of states that were absolutely convinced, not the states, but a couple of regulators in states that were convinced that this was illegal. It had to be. It could not possibly be allowed. One of them that was actually, he was on the verge of indicting me. He was in Utah. He was an ambitious state regulator who had a bachelor's degree in English. And he had a master's, he was pursuing a master's in music, and somehow he was one of the regulators in the state of Utah. And he had called me, told me, trying to scare me into signing a consent decree, that the indictment would be faxed to me any minute, any day, any second, just trying to bully me. Well, finally, I got myself to the point where I said, look, let's talk. Let's get out of this. I want to know about you. Let's just become personal here so we can get to know each other. After a while, he disclosed that he was a Mormon, and I told him that I was very interested in Mormonism. I found it to be a very attractive belief system. And then he went into converting me. I shit you not, this happened. And then he actually, instead of faxing me an indictment while we were on the phone, he actually went over to the fax machine. These were old fax. This was what back in the day. Faxed me the four sides of some pamphlet. And I said, well, I'm going to become a Mormon. And I never got indicted. Swear to God. If you want to be a consultant, consulting is scary and totally weird-ass sometimes. But anyway, that gives you an idea. Now, the state of Ohio was after me, too. And fortunately, I pointed them to some people I didn't like as being the reason that this deal was raw. And they indicted them. And so that was cool. But anyway, okay. So you have the federal regulation of securities markets, and you have the state regulation of securities markets. Understand this, and I want you to write this down. You cannot sell stock, unregistered stock. You cannot sell unregistered stock in non-exempt transactions. You cannot sell unregistered stock in non-exempt transactions. Now I'm going to explain this to you. Get your thinking caps on because this is absolute red meat for exam two. I can sell stock. I've got a little company. It has 1,000 shares authorized. I intend to keep it a very tiny company. But I own 500 of the shares. And I would actually kind of like to sell a little ownership just to get a little bit of money. Book value of the stock stands right now at maybe $12 a share, realistically. So I'd be willing to sell it at $10 a share, maybe 100 shares, to raise $1,000. And you, sir, look like someone I'd like to sell it to. Unfortunately, I can't quite do that. There are several ways I could do it without registering it. There is a set of exemptions from registration. The biggest ones are what are called the Regulation D exemptions. Otherwise, we call them Reg D exemptions. There are three of them. One is a very extremely cool one. But the regulation. There is Reg D 504, Reg D 505, and Reg D 506. Two of these create restricted stock. In other words, it is not, quote-unquote, freely tradable. 505 and 506 create restricted stock for the buyer. You cannot sell this stock to just anyone. And I'm not going to get into the details, but you have to be a sophisticated investor. I cannot say, hey, everybody, I've got some stock to sell. Here's some literature about it. That would make me some hard-timer's old lady at a federal prison. Only if you are a sophisticated investor, you have great knowledge yourself, you have the financial means to sustain a loss, and you are not stupid. You know what the risks are of this. I could probably sell it to you on exemption. I wouldn't have to tell anyone. I wouldn't have to file any forms. I could sell it to you. It would be straight up, boom, restricted under Rule 144. You couldn't do jack with it, except hold on to it. But you would be an owner, and we'd share in decision-making and all that great stuff. Reg D 505 and 506, they're slightly higher tiers. You can raise more with 506, but you have a little more restriction. Now, over time, and I never really got some of the nuances of this. I'm just honest with you. But theoretically, you can actually bundle less sophisticated investors under a sophisticated investor. So you might be kind of sophisticated, but you are very wealthy. You actually are no securities law. You know the risk. I might be able to bundle you two under you, and therefore be able to sell more stock. Now again, I didn't try that trick, and it got scary for me. What really qualified an investor to be bundled under somebody, and what had to be the qualification? I understood the qualification of the main player, but I really never was comfortable with how the bundling, what threshold these cats had to do, reach for that. But you can raise money, but they have Rule 144 stock. There's another one like this, too. It's called the Regulation A, the Reg A. We used to call it the Bob Marley because it was Reg A. That was sort of funny. Back the hell with you. Anyway, yeah, there were twice I remember very specifically, Alan, you wanted to do a Bob Marley. Oh, yeah. But anyway, that's another one you can use. But you have to follow the rules to do these. Reg A, you can raise a good pile of money, but you can't raise more than that. And you have to use an offering circular. It's like the cheapo version of a prospectus. I wrote a bunch of different offering circulars. There's a famous beer company that wanted to raise new money, equity money, and it was well known. You would recognize the name quite real quickly. But this was, I think, back in the 90s this happened, or in the 80s. It happened in my time as a consultant. What it did was, it wanted to raise money, so what it did was it put an offering circular in every six-pack bottle pack of its beer that it was selling. And it was a huge success. I mean, every beer-drinking, pot-bellied redneck on the planet bought some stock off this offering circular. And then the SEC came in and said, you've got to give all that money back, plus pay a ridiculously high fine, and do it again. Because they had raised far, far more than the limit of a Reg A. And they didn't know, you know, look at all this money coming in. Well, they couldn't just take all that money coming in. They just, the issue got oversubscribed. That's the term you'd use if you want to sound really butch. The issue was oversubscribed, and they didn't stop it. They just thought, this is so cool. And then they had to give back all the money, pay a pretty hefty fine, and go again. It didn't kill the company, but it sure taught them who was boss. Okay. Now there's one that is very extremely cool. The Reg D 504, called the $1 million offering. Now the $1 million offering, essentially, and this is a very simplistic approach to it, and it's more complicated now than it was back in my time. But the $1 million offering, you can raise up to $1 million through sales of common stock under certain conditions without registering it with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the stock is freely tradable. No Rule 144 on it. It's under very specific conditions. Now understand that anything that happens there's a federal interest, I can guarantee you in securities law will also have a state interest. And even though you might not have to do anything with the Securities and Exchange Commission, any place where you would make an offer or solicit for offers with that stock, you're going to have to fill out their forms. There is a uniform document called the U-1 that many states embrace. Not all states, but essentially you fill out this form once and then that works for a bunch of states so you can sell in those states. But you got to be careful about that. Be awfully careful. You can't even fart about your stock in some states, even if it's exempt from registration. So when I said you cannot sell stock, unregistered securities, in non-exempt transactions, these are the exemptions. And that is the exemption that's golden for small companies that need to raise money. A Reg D 504 still exists to this day, and the stock is freely tradable. But that's not the end of it. Even though you might have people who have freely tradable stock, they can't do anything with it unless the stock has a market, a secondary market. In other words, the next step after I would raise $1 million for a company on Reg D 504, I would have to get a stock exchange to give that company a ticker symbol so that it was listed, so that stockbrokers could see that company's buy orders and sell orders. That required, now I always went through the NASD. Only once did I go through another exchange, and that was the Amex. But in the NASD, they were a nightmare compared to the SEC. The SEC would essentially sit back and say, oh, the NASD, I would go to the NASD. I called there and I said, I need to get a ticker symbol. You fill out a form called the 15C211. Now, back in my time, I could do that. Now, only a lawyer can do it. Fill out the 15C211, which essentially it's like disclose. It's almost as bad as a registration statement, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Now, I started by working with the evilest, most vicious, hateful women you would ever want to meet. Her name was Claire. At the NASD. She was one of the compliance officers, and she was the gateway for a ticker symbol. She was mean, insulting, nasty. I got to know her so well that we became great friends, and she never stopped treating me like dog shit, but, I mean, that was part of why I liked her. She would not mess with me. And she actually helped me so that I could go to corporations. They would say, well, you're just a consultant. You can't tell us we have to do this. Okay, Claire told me you have to do this. Do you want to talk to Claire? I can call her up. No, I heard her on the phone with you. Good. Claire taught me incredible amounts about how to structure documents, what to say to cover your ass. Like even in the accounting statement, she explained that these were small, highly risky companies that might not survive. She said, always in a company like that, in the notes to the financial statement, the last note you should put, the financial statements of this company have been prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles consistently applied. The assumption is that the company would be a going concern, which might not be the case with the company that is the subject of these financial statements. That was essentially saying to every investor, watch it. These accounting statements might be completely useless to you because we assume going concern in accounting. This company might not survive two more days. Cool stuff. But anyway, okay. Get to 15C211, you get a trading symbol. Then what you have to have next is market makers. Now, in my world, you would use penny stock houses, and I had my own penny stock house, but you would essentially, they would agree to take in buy and sell orders. That's what market makers do. Every stock will have market makers. They will be the center points. Now, in my world, these penny stock brokers, they would start out, oh, you're going to do an issue, $1 million issue. Well, we need you to swing 20,000 of those shares our way. Just give us 20,000 shares. What? Hey, you want us to be your market maker? Yeah? Okay, you're going to get us 20,000 shares. Oh, God. And they say, look at it this way. We're going to have to make the market in a stock. If someone sells that and we honor that, we are going to be out the money that we paid for that stock from some disgruntled owner. You darn well better give us 20,000 shares. Plus, if we have 20,000 shares, we're going to be more favorable to bumping up that price in a fair way. Generally, you'd form, what I did was I would form something like 50,000 shares to them, with the understanding that they would call other penny stock houses, give each of them 5,000-10,000 shares, a couple more, so that I had market makers distributed around the country. Okay, now you're seeing the dark world. Now, by the way, you know why I'm telling you this? Because I'm telling you things that are actually, to some extent, illegal, but you see, the statute of limitations has run out. And second, I can edit the hell out of this podcast if I need to. Okay, so understand that. Now, the deal is this, though, that companies talk about going public. That means the company has common stock outstanding that is freely tradable and has a market in which that company's stock can be bought and sold in the secondary. A company can go public one of two ways. A company can go public by doing an initial public offering, an IPO. It sells original, new issue, common stock, or some twist on it to the public. Or it can file Form 10 to register already existing common stock. So in other words, I did a private placement to you, and you. I did a private placement. Now you're bitching at me because you really want freely tradable stock. So I could register that stock on Form 10. It's very much like going public, except that you're listing private stock that's already out there. Interestingly enough, there are quite a few times when an IPO, in the IPO, they will also register already existing restricted stock as part of the IPO. They'll be selling new issue stock, but they'll also list, okay, we're going to register this stock that was done in these private placements over the early years of the company. You could have that happen too. But a Form 10 or an IPO, now if you're going to do an IPO, technically a 504 is, a Reg D 504 is an IPO because it does create a public company. You know, I always kind of forget that actually is a slide around. But if you're going to do a real IPO, the big 800-pound monster would be to register the stock on Form S-1. I did only one Form S-1 in my life, in my time. I filed it with the Securities and Exchange Commission. A couple of days later, I got the deficiency notice back. It's a list of all the things the SEC didn't like about what I had done. 479 deficiencies on a fax. It nearly wiped out my brand new roll of fax paper. I called an old consultant. I got 479. So 479, he said, that ain't bad. What? Filed it again, fixed everything, got it back 10. It was went clear down to 10. Filed it the third time, and I'll be damned if I didn't get it back the qualification. Understand that no government entity ever approves anything. The term is it qualifies. You file the articles of incorporation with the state of Illinois, they don't approve those articles, they qualify them. You file a form S1 with the SEC, it doesn't approve it, it qualifies it. In other words, you may proceed now to the next step. Now, there are a couple of others that I'll just bring up. This isn't the only one. There are a couple down here for less money. There's a restriction on how big the company can be and how much money it's going to raise. There's the SB1 and the SB2. SB, small business, I guess. And then there are a few other weird-ass things like an S8, which I saw consultants get freely tradable stock through an S8. It was disgusting how they did that. But anyway. Now this form S1 or SB1, they all have kind of the same structure, pretty much. There's a first part of it that's just this technical information. And then there's the financial statements. But in the center is what will ultimately be the selling document. In the sandwich is the animal that will eventually be the prospectus. It is a monster. It is a selling document. It discloses everything about you down to the length of your butt crack. You just lay it all out, and then you have to, that's what you sell. And you may not give that prospectus to anyone until your date, the SEC gives you, arrives. Before that, you can field the prospectus, but it has to have red lettering on it, and that is called the red herring. It is not a selling document because it's a red herring, but you can hand it around carefully for review. But once the effective date happens, the prospectus no longer has red lettering on the front of it and all that. It's no longer a red herring. It is the real deal. And it is the only selling document for a securities offering. The only one. Like I said, the baby equivalent of it is called the offering circular. But understand, there's a notice that you can put. You'll see these in big papers like Barron's, Wall Street Journal, all that. It's like a big, looks like an advertisement. Ajax Corporation is going to sell 1 million shares of its common stock, par value 10 cents per share. At a projected price of $15 per share. That is not a selling document. It is called a tombstone. T-O-M-B-S-T-O-N-E, tombstone. It even says on it, this is neither an offer to sell nor a solicitation for offers to purchase the securities described below. The only document through which sales can be made is the prospectus, which may be obtained from. Now, the next thing you're going to see on this tombstone, and again, this is not a selling document. Don't let me bluff you, try to get you to think that a tombstone is. Technically, in reality, it is, but don't ever say that. You will see a list of these things, Goldman Sachs, Johnson & Leibowitz, Wilson, Henry, and George. You'll see these names. What this is the Investment Underwriting Syndicate. This is the group of companies with the lead underwriter at the top that will actually buy the stock from the company, and then they will sell it to you. You will... look at someone who has the look of an important person. You, woman, look like you're important. You will probably never actually buy original issue stock. Some investment bank, and that's what does this, these are called investment banks, will buy the stock from the company, and then they will sell it to you. Now, you actually aren't important. What they will do is they'll sell it to the very powerful, rich institutions, the trusts, and the individuals and families. They'll sell it to you. And then once you've gotten the run out of the stock, we'll sucker it off to you so that you suffer the fall. Okay? Welcome to the world of securities. We do it all the time. Now, if you are a big, fat, huge company, a Facebook, this is how it works. It's called a firm commitment underwriting. In other words, that investment banking syndicate is going to guarantee that the company gets its money. But remember, the syndicate's going to keep some of that. They're going to keep what we call the float. You might remember that I brought this up earlier, and that this whole chapter, essentially, I already covered it as far as the technical stuff goes. The float is what they'll keep, but they'll also make money by sucker punching people like you. But that's okay. Well, that's capitalism. Big companies get firm commitments. Now, in my world, what was called a best efforts. This is the big one. This is the desirable. The next one is called a best efforts underwriting. In other words, a group of investment bankers who would say, we'll do our best to sell your stock, but we won't give you any money unless we do. And we are not guaranteeing you that we will be able to sell enough of the stock to actually have a successful offering. We may have to take all that money back and give it back to the investors if we don't get enough subscriptions. This is called, when a group of investment banks does this, it's called a Western-style offering, as opposed to the Eastern-style, the Eastern bankers on the coast, is a firm commitment. The Western style is the best efforts. There is a third way that it can be done, which is perilous as hell. I have a story about that. There is what is called a self-underwriting, where the company's officials themselves can sell the stock, or try to. Self-underwriting was, most of the Reg D-504s that I pulled off were self-underwritings. Oftentimes, they expected me as the consultant to connect up with the rich people I knew and buy the stock. I could not do that because I wasn't a company official. And if I were to do it, I would be exposing myself to a couple of problems. One is the just the technicalities of it. I have to have insurance that I just could not afford. And second, rich people I knew, the rich, powerful investors, I was not going to put them into these kinds of investments. They didn't want to do this kind of crap. They wanted sexy stuff, interesting stuff. Self-underwritings were dangerous in my time, and they've gotten even worse. I remember some states, including one state that is extraordinarily hostile to public companies, Florida, requires that if a company wants to do a self-underwriting, the company has to register as a brokerage house and go through all the nightmare of NASD, Series 7, Series 24, Series 27, all that. Essentially, don't even dream of trying to build your own company in Florida. And there are other states like that too. So screw them. But anyway, there was a very strange consulting deal I had quite a few years back. Not all that many years back. It was in the early 1990s. It was in Ohio, in Akron. I had all these players that would call me. A lot of times it was just some complete hysterical, mythical thing like, oh, we got this giant ruby that needs to be brokered and all that. But this one, he was tended to be fairly reliable. He called me and he said, Alan, we got this little company. It's got something really incredible that it's doing. And I'd like you to go up there to Akron and just talk to them. Just talk to them. See if they're willing to, see if you can help them out. It was run by the guy that was the head of it was a really odd fellow. Very long, gray hair, skinny, and he smoked a pipe. Met a couple of guys like that. Another one I'll tell you about later smoked a cigar. But this guy, and he was very quiet. Turned out he'd been a CIA tech in the 60s and 70s. And he had developed a technology that was absolutely amazing for its time to create 3D holograms. And this was in the early 90s. Not only that, but his plan was medical. He was hologramming moving living hearts inside of people. And then he was setting up these conferences with his equipment around the world so the heart surgeons, he could get some heart surgeons together and they could watch this heart. And then the guy who was actually going to operate on the heart could be told, well, you got to watch out for this. Sometimes there's a nerve here where you cut and all. It was absolutely amazing, the technology. And plus he was doing some pretty early things with floating, spinning beer cans and stuff. It was amazing, but it was expensive. He had built this stabilization concrete pier 6 feet wide, 60 feet down into the ground in this back building in this doggy place in Akron. Great, okay? We might be able to pull something off. If you can show this, I actually do have some people who might be interested. I swear to God, they might. They set up the RIGD, they set up everything. They did an offering circular. They had already prepared the offering circular. And before I can't just call people and say, look, I got something, fly over here from wherever you are to see this. I was trying to set it up, and they started selling on the 504 themselves. State of Ohio's securities regulators got wind that there were these sales of stock going on. So they took one of the vice presidents, a guy who was a volunteer fireman when he wasn't working with this CIA guy in this company. They took him in and they started questioning him. They said, are any of the proceeds of the sale going to you, any of you officers personally? And the guy said, well, we kind of plan to, you know, give ourselves a little salary here because we'd like to eat. That was it. Company closed. They arrested him. They raided the offices, seized all of the equipment. I literally did not know about it until the day I drove up there, and it was just gutted. Everything was gone. State had come in through with the sheriffs of the county and just wiped out everything, and then they'd sold it to someone to recover expenses for their prosecution. Watch it. Doing a self-underwrite. Watch your step. And the old rule applies. Do not ever say anything to a regulator without a lawyer with you or someone else who's a bitch. Anyway, barrier three ways. You go public. You got stock trading, buying and selling. Now remember that you want to keep the price of your stock up. The cost of, remember that formula, you can find the price of a stock. It's the dividend in period one over the return minus G, okay? I'm not even going to write it. I don't want to do it that way. I want to just tell it to you this way. Your cost of your capital is debt capital. We're not quite to this point yet where I was going. That's 2 weeks from now. Is your debt capital cost you your interest? But it's after tax because you get to write off your interest expense against taxable income. And then there's your equity capital. Equity, your stockholders are a cost to you. They are a bitch of a cost to you. I guess I am going to have to write this down. The cost of equity capital. This is just a turnaround of that pricing formula I showed you before. It's in the textbook in this chapter too. Is your dividend over your price right now plus your growth rate. That's your cost of capital. Cost of existing shareholders. Your existing shareholders are a cost to you. It's a cost that is generally much higher than debt capital. So look what happens. As the price of your stock goes up, your cost of your shareholders goes down. That's why even though once the stock is trading out there, you're not selling the stock. So it does. You say, I've had these companies say, well, why should we care about the stock? We've already sold it. It's the owner's problem. No, it's not, because still inside your company, that capital has a cost to you. Those shareholders are part of your cost structure of the firm. It's even worse because the cost of new capital is that same formula, except that you have to take off the flotation off the price. If your stock sells for $50 and I sell you a share, I don't get $50. I get $50 minus what the seller, the broker, that underwriting syndicate there took. So in other words, new issue common stock is even worse than existing common stock because this denominator is smaller here, so K sub N, the cost of new common stock, is worse. But in any case, that price of that stock is part of your cost structure. The higher the price you keep, the lower the cost of your shareholders. When that price of that stock drops, you literally, your firm starts to run a fever because the cost of your equity, the equity part of your capital structure is higher. So we want to keep that stock price up. That means in the short run, realistically, you have to keep your shareholders happy. You have to give them good stories, good products, and all that. Some companies try to bullshit their way through life. They give out press releases that really don't mean a lot and all of that. But know this, the story comes to a head. Because regardless of how you go public, once you are public, you must file your forms with the federal government. Form you will file on a quarterly basis. Either, no matter what route you take, you will file Form 10Q every quarter. And at the end of every year, you will file Form 10K. Essentially, the Qs and Ks, as we call them, are amendments to the original filing, either on S1 or Form 10, however you did it. The Ks and Qs are periodic amendments, updating the information of the company. And they are glib as hell. You have to tell the SEC everything. And if you are researching a company for any class that you're in, I'll do this. I think I already did a little of this, but you will go the Form 10K, the Form 10Q. Those are original documents. Every son of a bitch who writes anything about a company, some expert, some guru, he has either gone to the Q's and K's to get the horse's mouth, or he is too stupid to know that those are the originating documents. I don't care where you go. You can have analysis of them, breakdowns of them, but the originals are what the company files with the federal government. And that includes the financial statements as well. Now, there was a time when there was some gaming done. Most companies have always been very honest. I've written K's and Q's. They are monstrous, exhausting documents. They can run hundreds of pages. But there's a particular place in there. If you're researching a company, go to the MD&A, the Management Discussion and Analysis. Those cats who write those for companies, whether they outsource it to lawyers or they have their own people do it, they are glib as hell. There are graphs, there are charts, there are tables, and they will tell you every last thing, and they're very honest about it. It's called the MD&A, the Management Discussion and Analysis. Management Discussion and Analysis. And I'll show you one next week. I mean, but there were companies back in the day that gamed it. Enron, companies like that, lied through their teeth. Several reforms have come about. Sarbanes-Oxley, SOX, and Frank Dodd have made it so that the officers and directors of the company can end up being personally held criminally liable for lies. Realistically, what that's done, quite honestly, it's the intention is absolutely great. But it's pretty much all of these new regulations, both in securities and in banking, they've just turned this they've turned it into a place where only huge corporations with powerful lawyers and accountants can survive. Essentially, one of the causes of why the banking industry is consolidating into an oligopoly and why investment banking is consolidating into an oligopoly is simply that no one can function. I was blown out years ago. They just said, why are you even here? You're so tiny, we'll just put you in prison right away. I was out. As things went on, I've talked to bank presidents. They say, we'll be gone in a couple of years. They'll just come in. The requirements are so incredibly intense and so difficult to meet and even to understand, much less to meet. They're saying, we'll be gone. We'll be sold to some larger bank soon. In the investment banking world, you're out of your freaking mind to even try a self-underwriting. And you probably are going to be stupid to even try best efforts because those little penny stock houses are just being blown out right and left now. That's the reality of the world that we are in. You want safety and security. That comes at the price of having a more varied landscape of players. And don't get me wrong, in my time there were players that were as corrupt as hell, and I don't know what the answer would be, but we've all, as a nation, we have chosen the answer. Okay, look, that's the background. Now every year the shareholders meet to vote for the board of directors. Now, woman, you own 100 shares, a round lot, in Megacorp International. Now, you could go to the annual shareholders meeting, put on some really nice clothes, and walk around looking very mysterious. Who is that? I think it's some important shareholder. Of course, eventually we'll figure out that you are nothing. So we really, it's okay if you don't come, you know. So what we'll do is we'll send you a proxy statement. And this card, it'll explain, and there'll be a big proxy explanation behind it. If you sign this card, it will give the proxy issuer, I'm an important person. I'm on the board of directors. I want to elect myself. So what I'll do is the board of directors will send out, please vote for our slate. by giving us your share votes. Okay? That's the proxy. The proxy, you're proxying to me. So I will gather up thousands of you tiny shareholders, and that'll just give me more weight so that our slate of directors can be elected again. But here's where the fun can begin. Because you know that my board of directors, we suck. We've been letting this company flail and flag for years. It's still got old technologies. It's not hip and with it moving forward. And so we have a black knight. Who looks like a black knight in here? You look like an evil person. You're the black knight. You have a competing slate of directors. You're going to send out, you've got some shares, your own voting shares. You're going to try to get enough proxies on your own competing proxy shares to vote your slate in, and my slate doesn't win. And the company essentially gets taken over. You fire the existing management, and that's the end of the story. Game over. Okay? Now, you might actually, you'll have to file a form to do this, but you might start buying shares of the company quietly in the open market, in the secondary market, to give you even more voting power. Okay? So the Black Knight is there to essentially do a hostile takeover. You're actually maybe even a corporation, and you want to take this corporation away from me. I am the old family that's founded this. Now, by God, we'll do things the old way. Who the hell are these people? Vote for us. We'll show you how the damn company is supposed to be run. And you're saying, no, vote for us. Black Knight. That's not the end of it, though. What I might do is I'll look to you. You're a white knight. Okay, you work with us. You go out there and you start buying shares. And you send and you support our proxy. You get competing shares. You start buying. Buy shares so that there comes into it a white knight. What's happening is as you buy and you buy, the price goes up and the battle gets very expensive. The price goes way above what anyone thought it could possibly be, but this becomes a blood battle because I am the old school, I'm the old guard, and I'm going to do whatever. We'll give you several seats on the board of directors. We'll give you hell. We'll give you control of this goddamn corporation. Just don't fire us. And you're saying, that's okay. We got money. We'll just keep buying and buying the stock, pushing the price up. That makes it your nose start to bleed. I mean, you're a white knight, but I mean, have you ever seen a white knight ride in, you know, I'm going to save you, fair maiden, and suddenly after a while there's this monstrous dragon standing there. Uh-oh, a dragon. Oh, wait a minute. Fire-breathing dragon. Okay, anyway, and so it begins to hurt you, and we'll just see how much pain you can take before you say FTS and you walk away. Maybe you won't, but the price goes up. All the shareholders are saying, this is great, this is cool. We'll sell our shares. But will they sell them to you or to you? If you offer higher bids, then they'll sell them to you. If you offer higher bids, they'll sell them to you. But in any case, the price goes up, it gets to be a very fine. And you, although you're still not important, in a very material way, you become part of an important process because those little shares of yours and those little shares of everyone else might tip the balance one way or the other toward whether the company stays with the old school or goes to the new kids on the block. You got the idea there? Okay. And it gets so cool because, look, you might be a very large corporation. So what's really happening is a friendly takeover. But to spare feelings, we won't call it a takeover. We'll call it a merger. Even though I'm going to be your bitch, I mean, it's a merger, okay? It's not a takeover. That's a hostile takeover. That's a friendly takeover. Merger. This is a damnable hostile takeover by a black knight, some predator. They don't know how this company works. Sometimes they're great. Sometimes this is the best thing. It's just end the old school. Sometimes it's a horrible thing. Hewlett-Packard, the old family, was blown out by subterfuge and intrigue involving the CEO they had put in. Does anyone know who I'm talking about? The HP CEO who turned against the company?
Carly.
Yeah, Carly herself, good old Carly. She drilled the company into the ground, and her whole group pretty much ruined the company for a while. But that's the background for this proxy fight. So if you buy shares, you're not important unless something very cool happens. But anyway, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.